It's great to be with you during this Lenten season. I appreciate Brandon's invitation to be here. I've really enjoyed the devotional book that you all put together of different people from the church writing devotionals from the book of Matthew. Thank you to those of you who did that and participated in that. I do appreciate that. I've enjoyed reading those. And I also want to thank Andy for his message last week about doubt. It was a great message, and I love the thought that doubt doesn't necessarily reveal a lack of faith, but I believe that doubt is a prelude to deeper faith. So anyway, Brandon asked me to continue this series by sharing a story with you tonight from the Gospel of Matthew, and the story that he assigned me to preach about was from Matthew 17, and it is the story that most of us know as the story of the Jesus on the mountain of transfiguration. And so it begins in verse 1 in chapter 17 with these words. 6 days later, Jesus took Peter and the two brothers, James and John, and he led them up a high mountain to be alone. Now this mountain is unnamed in Matthew's account, but most scholars believe it to be Mount Tabor, which doesn't mean much to most of us. But it was probably the highest mountain in that a land of Caesarea Philippi where the disciples and Jesus were hanging out at that time. And I don't think Jesus chose that mountain purely because of its height. I don't think it was its prominence that necessarily caused Jesus to choose that place to have this transfiguration experience, because this mountain was significant in Israel's history. It was a place where many battles had been won and some lost, and it became a sacred, holy place for the nation of Israel. And I don't think it was an accident that Jesus took the three stooges with him to go up there that day. Number verse 2. As the men watched, Jesus' appearance was transformed so that his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as light. Some different translations mention that Jesus was transformed, or more accurately, transfigured from the inside out. Not as though he was merely reflecting some external source of light, but was from deep within himself actually creating this light. Isn't that an interesting thought? Some other translations mention that this transfigured Jesus shone brighter than any other thing on earth. What's the brightest thing that you've ever seen? He was brighter than that. Must have been something. In Luke's account of the Mount of Transfiguration, he mentions that the disciples had all fallen asleep. Well, they were awake now. As soon as Jesus was transfigured, they were awakened. But it gets better. Listen, continue with me. Stay with me. Verse 3. Suddenly, Moses and Elijah appeared and began talking with Jesus. And Peter exclaimed, "Lord, it's wonderful for us to be here. If you want, I'll make three shelters as memorials, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." Now, I don't mean or want to be disrespectful, but I'm a bit amused by Peter's response here. Now, granted, in Luke's gospel, at the sight of this glowing Jesus and Moses, who's been dead for at least 5,000 years, and Elijah, who was one of the two guys in the Old Testament that didn't ever died, Peter says, none of the disciples knew what to say. And so Peter just blurted out the first thing that came to his mind. That makes sense to me. And he said, "Let me build three shelters or houses or tents or tabernacles, one for Moses, one for Elijah, and one for you, Jesus." And my mind wonders, where'd they think they were going to sleep? Why didn't the disciples build their own tent? Or maybe they thought they were all going to get to choose their favorite hero and bunk in with them. I don't know what they were thinking, but it just seems odd to me that they... Anyway, isn't that just like us, though? Whenever some great or glorious thing happens, we immediately want to preserve the moment. Right? I was at a little, this isn't in the sermon, I don't know who's running that back there, but hang on, I'll get back to the, but I was at the little graduation thing for the kids at the Open Door. These are preschool kids, they have a little graduation thing. And so it was down at McCabe, and it was in the basement, and the room was full of moms and dads and grandpas and grandmas, and then these 20 or 7, 28 little kids. And everybody in the room had a phone or a camera watching the deal. Except me. I was in the background. I thought, this is weird. Everybody is watching this event on a screen so they can take it home and watch it on a bigger screen. And I thought, that's we all want to sort of preserve those moments. This is what Peter was trying to say. Let's build some permanent houses and just stay here. Let's do our best to preserve this mountaintop moment. Nuts to the other disciples. Forget about the valley. Who cares about the people who need Jesus down there? Let's just do everything we can to stay right here. This is awesome. We must be special. See why I called them stooges? This mountaintop experience is so cool. Let's just preserve this moment. We don't care about the future. We only care about right now. Does any of that sound like anything any of you might ever think or say? It's just me. Okay. Well, let's get back to our story in verse 5. But even as he spoke, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my dearly loved son, who brings me great joy. Listen to him." It does get better. If Moses and Elijah are not enough, now this voice from heaven speaks. And I would guess that the disciples probably felt it as much as they heard it. But notice, the voice comes from a cloud that overshadowed them. Now, I can get my head around this cloud appearing above them, but one of the translations of this passage says it this way. Even as he spoke, a bright cloud outshone them. Now remember, Jesus has just been described as the brightest thing that we've ever seen on earth. And this cloud somehow outshines even that. That's a pretty good description of God, I think. And this voice, reminiscent of the voice that spoke to Jesus at his baptism, now speaks to all of them. Probably even to Moses and Elijah, who up to this point were thought of by good Hebrews as the two primary sources of Old Testament authority. Moses representing the law, and Elijah representing the prophets. God now says to them and to the disciples, "This is my son. Listen to him." No longer do you listen to Moses. No longer do you listen to Elijah. From now on, listen to my son. His words and authority outweigh and overshadow everything that has gone on before. This is my son, the Messiah. Well, now it finishes up. Look at verse 6. The disciples were terrified, and they fell face down on the ground. And then Jesus came over, and he touched them. And he said, "Get up. Don't be afraid." And when they looked up, Moses and Elijah were gone, and they saw only Jesus. And as they went back down the mountain, Jesus commanded them, "Don't tell anyone what you've seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." Yeah, right. Like that's going to happen. What really is the point or the message of this fascinating little story? Well, I think there's three. Well, there's probably a lot more than that, but I'm going to focus on three primary messages that I see in this story tonight. Number one, this story's primary purpose was to establish the identity of Jesus as the Messiah. Remember that Matthew was written, recorded, primarily for a group of Jews or Hebrews. One of the basic and long lingering questions that all Jews and all Hebrews had to answer then and still have to answer today is, Jesus really the Messiah? Frankly, all of us have to answer that question. Is this Jewish carpenter's kid really the fulfillment of the 300 Old Testament prophecies recorded about him? Is this miracle-working vagabond with the 12 smelly fishermen followers really the one we've been waiting for almost 6,000 years? Yeah, it appears so. In the 16th chapter, if you've been following along or reading along, or if you just know the Bible that well, immediately prior to this event on the mountaintop, Jesus had had this conversation with the disciples where he said, what are people saying about me? Who do people say that I am? And they offered some responses, and then he asked them, who do you think I am? And Peter again blurted out on behalf of the rest of the crew, well, you're the Messiah. You are the Messiah, the one that we've been waiting for. Now stay with me. Once Peter announces that, Jesus then launches into the most radical, one of the most radical things that any of those disciples had heard to this point. Jesus tells them that they're right, but his messiahship will not be ushered in with an heroic overthrow of the oppressive Roman government, but rather, his messiahship will be ushered in by his capture, his torture, his trial, his death, and only then his resurrection. That's what will usher in his messiahship. The disciples would hear none of that talk. Peter took a stab at rebuking Jesus and got rebuked himself. All of this discussion about the Messiah is what led to this event on the mountain. Where what happened? His identity as the Messiah, fulfilled by the presence of Moses and Elijah, all culminates in that one single moment. All the overarching authority that fulfills all of the prophecies and completes all of the law are now found and housed in this one man, my son. Listen to him, Jesus the Messiah. Second, so the first part, remember that the first meaning of this story is to establish the identity of Jesus as the Messiah. Here's the second. This story is about the importance of mountaintop experiences and not getting stuck there. Okay? We've all had some mountaintop experiences, and we all probably have a tendency to try to get stuck there and preserve them forever. What is it about our mountaintop experiences that cause us to want to preserve them forever? Well, I think it usually relates to three things, and we see it in the story. Number one, we want to preserve our mountaintop experiences because of the people we meet there. Peter, James, and John found themselves in the presence of two of their Old Testament heroes, plus they saw Jesus intersect humanity and divinity, mortality and eternity in that one glorious moment. Plus they hear God's voice. Who can blame them for wanting to capture that moment? Billy Graham just died, and millions of people mourned his passing, while millions of others welcomed him to heaven because of the influence he had on their life. Many of us can point to specific people who have been part of introducing us to or developing our faith. And it's not wrong to have faith heroes, but we must remember who it is that we worship, God's Son. Listen to him. Secondly, I think some people want to try to preserve their mountaintop experiences because of the places they take place. On this historically significant place, they sought to build three tents and spend the night, and longer if possible. Who of us has not been to camp somewhere, or to a retreat center, or a church, or a chapel, or a college, or even the Lair camp meeting, and not wish that we could stay there forever? I remember year after year, closing of my, at the camp I started in the Black Hills called The Rock That Doesn't Roll, kids, middle school kids, would come crying and lamenting having to go home to the real world. And I tried to remind them that their special experiences at this special place were in fact the real world. That other world they had to go home to was the screwed up one. But none of us could stay there. We all had to go home, except those that were going to do the dishes. We didn't want to do that. So. Sometimes it's the places that make us get stuck. And thirdly, sometimes people get stuck because of the timing. This Mount of Transfiguration experience marked the middle point. It happens right about the middle of the gospel in all three of the gospels that record it. It marks a turning point in the relationship between Jesus and his disciples. Some would maybe even say it was a tipping point for the disciples in their commitment to being followers. Prior to this moment, they have primarily just watched and observed. They participated sparingly. Most of they were just along for the ride. But at this point, when Jesus invites them to come along with him and die, things just got real. I've known way too many people who got stuck with their salvation experience that happened 10 or 30 or 50 years ago, and they've never moved on. When you ask them what God has been teaching them lately, they turn again to the beginning. Now, there's nothing wrong with the beginning, but God doesn't want us to build tents and live there. We have to move on. We have to grow up. We have to reach out. We have to give all. We don't live in the past, and we can't preserve the moment. With God, there is always a future. And that leads us to the third lesson from this great story. Thirdly, this story is about following Jesus into the valley. It is so subtle that we oftentimes overlook it or run by it or miss it. Following the Old Testament heroics, the glorified transformation, the voice from heaven, the disciples fall on their faces, we hope in an act of worship, but more likely they were terrified, and Jesus touches them, each one of them, and invites them to join him as they head back down the mountain. Why? What's back in the valley? The other disciples, and as each gospel records, the valley is full of people who are full of needs. My friends, Jesus' pathway of discipleship most certainly includes various and spiritually significant mountaintop experiences. But hurting people live in the valleys and the byways of the world. And that is ultimately where Jesus invites us to follow. If all we had to do to be a disciple was accompany Jesus to some mountain and build some shelters and live there, this place would be packed tonight. Because that'd be easy. Right? The coach that I coached football with for 8 years at Dakota Wesleyan was fond of saying, if football was easy, there wouldn't be enough shoulder pads to go around. It's the same thing. If all we had to do to be a disciple was accompany Jesus to the mountain and build some shelters and live there, that's too easy. But Jesus' call is to follow him to the valleys and to the cross and only then to the other side. That's a more challenging ask and a more difficult answer. And that is the point of the story. Do you believe that Jesus is the Messiah? Have you experienced your own mountaintop of salvation and determined not to build a tabernacle there? Will you follow Jesus back into the valleys and the alleys and the backwater places to which he's called all of us? That's the point. Or have you gotten stuck at some special place, at some special time, with some special person? It's time to follow all the way. A few years ago, now let's be honest, a lot of years ago, I was leading the youth ministry efforts of the South Dakota Annual Conference. And one fall, I accompanied a group of youth from all across South Dakota to a leadership development conference at Estes Park, at the YMCA camp of the Rockies at Estes Park, Colorado. Some of you been there? Yeah, it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. Well, one afternoon we had free time, about 5 hours of free time in the afternoon, and these kids convinced me to take them deeper into the mountains and go for a hike. Now remember, I'm a flatlander from Iroquois, South Dakota, where it's so flat you can watch your dog run away for 2 weeks. I was a stranger to these mountains, but the kids were unrelenting. So off we went. We pulled into this abandoned parking lot where there was a looked like an official board at some time that had an official map that was gone. There was a little hand-drawn little map thing. Follow that. All right, so we took off. We took off on this hike. You know how the kids are. And this was a year or so after, some of you are old enough to remember this, after all those kids got killed on Mount Hood. They were hiking on Mount Hood in Washington and got killed. So guess what's on my mind? We're hiking along and starting to get colder and we're going up higher and then it starts to rain and then it starts to sleet and then it starts to snow and these kids are, they're doing anything they can to try to get, they're taking the trash out of the trash bags, cutting a hole in them, putting them on over top of their tank tops and they have flip-flops on and I'm like, I know we're all gonna die on the hill. And anyway, we just kept going. I just knew there had to be a turn at some point and we're gonna turn around and go back to the parking lot, right? Well, anyway, we kept hiking and weather kept getting worse until we finally cleared the timberline. We hiked above the timberline. And once we cleared the timberline, I could see the trail. And it made a big U-turn and sure enough, we made it back down to the abandoned parking lot and nobody had stolen our van and everybody lived. But I learned something that day. Not much grows above the timberline. Growth happens in the valleys of our world. That mountaintop experience was exactly what I needed to find my way back. But not much grows up there. We absolutely need mountaintop experiences to help us gain perspective on our lives and to make some life-altering choices. We need those experiences, but we can't live there. Nothing much grows on the mountain. Life happens in the valleys. Most of us, if we'd be honest, would report that the times when we've been closest to God have not been on those mountaintop experiences, but in some valley experience of our life. Am I right? Yeah. We need both mountains for perspective and commitment and valleys for life and growth. And I hope we'll continue to learn this lesson and commit to following the Messiah. Listen to him. Amen. Amen.